Well, we've heard in the morning talks essentially about thermal emission, X-ray emission from accretion disks around black holes and other compact objects. Now we're going to switch to the jets, which go perpendicular to the accretion disks, and where the emission is usually non-thermal, often synchrotron emission. And here's basically an outline of what I'm going to try to cover. In 1 hour, of course, it's very hard to review a lot of stuff about all the observations that have been made about jets and certainly associated with black holes. So I'm going to give an introduction which is going to show you basically the variety of jets, morphologies you see, and different types of sources that might give rise to jet emission. I'll go through sort of a basic model which discusses relativistic flows, superluminal motion, and the various characteristics of jets that are moving very close to the speed of light. Then I'll move on to what I consider current issues, which are the real problems, what we really don't understand all that well. And there's several nagging problems in this field. And some of the newer results that have occurred in the last few years, basically because of the advent of the VLB array and also of space VLBI. One of the highlights, of course, of this is the actual imaging of circumnuclear disks in many ways, both through molecular emission and through absorption, free absorption of synchrotron jets. And then if I have enough time, I'll try to close on the discussion of the nearest AGN, which is, of course, the galactic center, and the strange case of Sagittarius A star, which doesn't seem to be anything like other objects, even though there's probably a massive black hole in that also. Well, the granddaddy of all extragalactic radio sources is Cygnus A. If we get the lights down a little bit in front, it might help on this view graph. Certainly a long time ago, in the late 50s and early 60s, there was a lot of clear evidence that radio galaxies had very big lobes of emission. In Cygnus A, they're separated by, well, not quite a megaparsec, but a huge distance. The minimum energies that are in those radio lobes are quite huge. I'm sure you're mostly aware of this. They can go up to 10 to the 61 ergs in particles and fields, which is just an astoundingly large number. It takes about 10 to the 7th solar masses totally converted into energy to give you this amount of energy. Now, they're very large structures, and so maybe that isn't so astounding to you. But all of the emission, all of the power for these radio lobes comes through very narrow little jets, and you can probably barely see this jet here on this VLA image at 6 centimeters wavelength of Cygnus A, and points right down to the center, down to the very center of the galaxy, and indicates that all of this energy has to come from a region that's much less than a parsec, that's much less than the distance from us to the nearest star. And therefore, even if you can assume, for example, an efficiency of converting mass to energy of 10%, you have to run something like 100 million stars through the volume of space that's much smaller than between us and the nearest star. That's certainly an astounding thing to think about. Well, jets, large scale radio emission from radio galaxies sort of comes in two flavors. This is one of them. It's called a Fanaroff-Riley class 2 source, and the main characteristics are that you have most of the brightness out in the outer parts and fairly weak jets connecting them. There's another class called Fanaroff-Riley class 1 objects, which have very interesting jet morphologies on the kiloparsec scale. This is an optical and a radio picture superimposed. The red is the radio and the blue is the optical. And you see that in this case, the lobes, which you might consider to be out here, for example, in the red, are dimmer and the jet is brighter. There's more contrast between the jet and the lobe. And that's the main morphological distinction between class 1 and class 2 sources. There's an amazing property that the radio power tells you exactly which class you're in almost all sources. If the radio power at about 1 gigahertz is less than about 10 to the 25th watts per hertz, then you're in a class 1 source, and if you're greater than that, you're in a class 2 source. And it's been a mystery for a long time why you have such a sharp morphological change. And there have been two theories put out in the literature very recently, in the last couple of years, that might relate to this. There's the magnetic switch that's been discussed by Meyer and collaborators in a recent paper in Nature, which basically says that if the Alphane speed is greater than the escape speed, in other words, if magnetic forces are dominant over gravitational forces, then you can get the class 2 sources and the other way around for class 1 sources. And also an interesting idea has been put out recently in a paper by Reynolds looking at discussing M87, which is a sort of actually bridges these two classes of objects, and that the distinction may have something to do with ADAF flows versus radiative flows in accretion disks. Okay, well, it's well known, and we're all very familiar with active galactic nuclei that give rise to these very large-scale jets. And from the morning's talks, it shouldn't come as a surprise if you've not seen them, that galactic objects such as SS-433, an OB star plus a neutron star in a binary, exhibit very strong and rapidly changing jets at radio wavelengths. Here's several maps made with the Merlin array in England showing the source SS-4033 basically on roughly adjacent days, starting in the upper left and going down to the lower right. You can see that there's a clear double-sided jet morphology in this source. And you can very well model this source having a flow of relativistic electrons going down the jet at about a quarter of the speed of light, and having the jet inclined to the line of sight by 80 degrees, that is, the jet is almost in the plane of the sky as you view it. And this was modeled first and most accurately with the VLA results by Gelming and Johnson quite a while ago. This clearly shows that there's relativistic flows of electrons down these jets. It agrees with the hydrogen line velocities, and I think SS-43 is a pretty well understood system, at least dynamically. A very pretty artist conception I found on the web and put it in here, courtesy of NASA, of a companion star, an accretion disk, and then the jets going out in both directions from a source like SS-433. And I'm going to try to show examples of a sort of a toy model, of which this is one example below here, to give you a flavor of what sort of morphological effects you can get by changing viewing angles and speeds of motions of jets throughout this talk. And so basically in this model, this is taking the parameters of the jet model from the Gelming and Johnson paper, and actually I've rotated on the plane of the sky to match this artist's conception. SS-433 is tipped over that way, as I showed you earlier. The blue dots here represent blobs that are sent off periodically, regularly in this model, and they go off ballistically. So, for example, this little blob here started here a while ago and went off in this direction, whereas this blob was emitted at a later time and has gone ballistically in this direction. This is for a precessing cone that spits out these blobs. The blue-colored ones are the ones that are aimed more towards you than away from you, in the forward jet, and the red ones are in the receding jet. In SS-433, there's not a lot of difference between the two. And the area of these blobs corresponds to the intensity that you would see. So incorporated into this model is that the blobs decay with time in their radio emissivity as they go away from the nucleus. There's a little diagram down here in these plots to orient you. The origin of the jets is at the center. The observer is where these two spherical lines cross in latitude and longitude, if you like. Here's zero latitude, zero longitude. And this cone shows you the direction of the forward jet, which in this case is up and nearly in the plane of the sky, and gives you an idea about how big the opening angle is. Now I'll show you a few of these when I try to show you how other sources might be explained by such jets. Well, another fascinating object, galactic object, is GRS 1915 plus 105. Again, a source we've heard a lot about this morning. This is the famous microquasar discovered by Felix Mirabal and Luis Rodriguez. And this again is some Merlin array observations on roughly almost daily basis of the jet emission from 1915, showing that it expands very rapidly on the sky. The blobs appear to move ballistically, that is, no acceleration or deceleration has really been measured very accurately. And the inferred speed coming from modeling the rate of outflow of these blobs, that on the plane of the sky they appear to move faster than the speed of light, and even though the jet is nearly in the plane of the sky, this indicates that the actual material that's flowing down these jets is going at about 90% of the speed of light. So it's clear, I think, from all of the talks you've heard today and from observations of sources like GRS 1915, SS-433, and the others, that you can certainly get nice collimated jets with blobby emission that move at nearly the speed of light from the objects I showed you at the beginning, the supermassive black holes in radio galaxies, and also from galactic scale objects where you're talking only about a few to 10 or so solar masses. But there's a caveat to all this. If you just look at jets, you can find many other types of jets that have nothing to do with black holes, have nothing to do with supermassive objects, or things like that. And I just wanted to give you two examples so that every time you see a jet, you don't automatically think that it's got something to do with compact objects. The upper example is a low-mass star-forming region. At the center here, there is a star, presumably one or two solar masses, that's just forming. It sends out jets of molecular emission and thermal emission, basically. The red color on here is shock-excited molecular hydrogen at 2 microns. The contours are molecular CO emission, so this is clearly an object that is not at extreme temperatures. It allows molecules to exist in dust. And this is the radio continuum at very high frequencies or millimeter wavelengths. So you can have a jet-like source from a very low-mass star that has nothing to do with any compact objects. You can go to high-mass star-forming regions. This is the W30H region. Here's an ultra-compact H2 region from a radio map. And this is powered by a recently formed O star, and it's ionized by the photons from the O star. And you can see sort of a jet-like trail of emission away from this at low levels, which is probably just a puncture of the H2 region. It's overpressured compared to its surrounding medium, and hot ionized gas can escape from it that way. Now, everything I've shown you so far on these star-forming region jets is thermal emission. And you could say, well, okay, any time I see non-thermal emission, presumably I have a compact object that's driving it. Well, it turns out in the same region, there's an object over here called the Turner-Welch object, which is presumably a high-mass star that's just formed. And it's hard to see on this image because it's very weak, but it has sort of a double-sided, wiggling, mirror-symmetric jet that comes out of this. And if you look at the radio spectrum from this object, you find it has a spectral index of minus 0.6, which is characteristic of almost all non-thermal radio jets, extragalactic and galactic. And so you can even have non-thermal synchrotron emission coming from a star-forming region, giving you a double-sided wiggling jet. So one must be careful, if one just looks at these things, not to always infer that there are black holes in them. Well, let's move on to the standard favorite source for extragalactic jets, M87. We've seen this before yesterday. I'm only bringing this up to remind you of the very high speed seen in optical light from what is thought to be an accretion disk very close in to the nucleus of M87. This is this HST image, indicating an enclosed mass of about 3 billion solar masses. One interesting thing, and will be important a little bit later, and when I show you the radio maps, is the inclination of this disk. Now, I always have a hard time when optical astronomers show a smudge on very distant, on a plate of a very distant galaxy and say, this is clearly an SAB galaxy. What is the orientation of that disk on there? It's actually a crucial question that'll come up. And you can essentially try to look at the isophotes and see if it's elliptical. And what I heard from Holland Ford and have seen in print is that the ellipticity of this suggests that if it were round to begin with, that the disk in M87 must be inclined by about 45 degrees to the line of sight. So keep that number in mind, because it'll come back to haunt us a little bit later. So what does M87 look like at radio wavelengths? It has fascinating structures on all scales. Starting with the largest scales, this is a radio map made at about 1 meter wavelength recently with the VLA, when they upgraded to include very low frequency capability. This comes from work by Fraser Owen and Gene Eilick. And the scale across this slide here is about 100 kiloparsecs. This is a fairly nearby source. And so the radio emission that most of us are familiar with, which is pictured down here, all falls in this very bright red outlined area here. And this is the standard radio jet that comes out of M87. But clearly there are much, much larger radio emitting structures, for example, this sort of ear-like object that comes out here, that undoubtedly have something to do with the jet-like emission coming from the center of M87. And it's interesting to note, Fraser Owen noted at the AAS meeting, that the energy that's being put into this region by the radio jets, this huge, huge region, is comparable to the energy that's being dissipated by the cooling flow, or what has been called a cooling flow, from the cluster of galaxies, of which M87 is the dominant galaxy in the Virgo cluster. So this reopens the question, at least, of what is powering the X-ray emission at the largest scales in clusters of galaxies like this. But that's a topic for another colloquium, not this one. Okay. The crucial thing to see here, which is characteristic of almost all of these types of objects, is that when you have a bright jet, as you see here, here's the nucleus of the galaxy, and a few kiloparsecs down, this jet continues out and is very bright, seen optically and also seen in the X-ray as synchrotron emission, is that this jet is one-sided. It's strongly one-sided. All attempts to find a counterjet over here have failed. And this is essentially a property of very, very many radio sources and has to be explained. Well, if you look with much, much higher resolution, this was done with about an arc second or so resolution using the VLA. You now use the VLB array and look much deeper inward, or actually an older version of the VLB array than the VLBI network. And you get images that look like this. This is the very, very central portion, the central parsecs of M87, viewed at fairly long radio wavelengths, about 18 centimeters, or 1 gigahertz. And you see a bright nucleus. Now we're down in the subparsec scale here. And a very one-sided jet that goes off on exactly the same position angle as the kiloparsec scale jet I just showed you a minute ago. These are three different exposures of this jet. This image, just to show you different bright features at different brightnesses. And I'm going to come back in a few minutes to discuss some of the features in this jet, which are very interesting. So what is the reason? What's been the standard reason to explain one-sided jets? Well, the story starts like this. You assume that the jets are two-sided intrinsically. They're symmetric. And so you can make a very simple source up that puts, for example, a massive black hole in here with an accretion disk. And it sends out jets in the forward and the receding direction. And I've tilted this so it's mostly in the plane of the sky, as was seen in most of the galactic sources. Many aspects of radio sources can be explained like this. For example, there's a frequency-dependent opacity, and such that you see much, much higher optical depth nearer to the core. And when you go down the jet, you tend to get more optically thin emission. And it's a sum of many components like this that gives the standard radio spectrum, which tends to be fairly flat for most of these objects. But what happens if we now take this jet model, same model, and instead of having the jet in the plane of the sky, tilt it towards you. And you get dramatic effects, provided the material in the jet is moving nearly the speed of light. So that same model now becomes this one. Now you can see a very, very strong blue-shifted component for the jet, very strong forward components in the jet. You see very weak components coming from the far side of the receding part of the jet. And this has been explained for a long time, it goes back to Martin Rees, I think, that you get strongly boosted Doppler boosting for the forward component, and the intensity that you would see from that jet when it's in the plane of the sky, if you tilt it towards you, gets boosted by the Doppler factor roughly to the third power, and there's a spectral index correction. And there are some subtleties in this argument, but that's not important for this meeting. Now, the Doppler factor is essentially the relativistic Lorentz factor, and it's got divided by 1 minus the flow speed in units of the speed of light in the jet times cosine theta. And basically what is happening here is that this Doppler factor can get very large if the denominator can go to zero. And the denominator can go to zero when beta is near 1, that is the material is moving at the speed of light, and when cosine theta is near 1, that is the jet is moving directly at you. You get these large Doppler shifts. At the same time, the emission from the receding part of the jet, this weak little red thing you can see in here, is diminished by basically the same effect. And the ratio of the jet to the counter jet intensities goes as 1 plus beta cosine theta divided by 1 minus beta cosine theta to some exponent, which is roughly third power. And that can explain why you see very one-sided jets. And it's been the standard explanation for a long time. Well, what about the projection of the individual blobs, which are all smeared together on this plot? What happens in this exact same model when you space the blobs out a little further? Well, you get superluminal motion. So basically what I've done is I've just spaced things out a little more, and you can see the blobs of the plasma that have been emitted at nearly the speed of light towards us from about this position. There's one here, one emitted a little earlier here, and then here, and then here, and here. There's 6 that are showing here. The ones that went out the backside are all bunched together in here and trail off. There are hundreds of them. I think I put 200 on that plot, actually. So you can see just from this plot that these blobs are moving much, much faster. They traverse angles across the sky very, very quickly, whereas the receding emission, the blobs that are on the receding jet go very slowly. And so basically that's the superluminal motion effect, and it occurs when you have small angle emission. The apparent speed that you see in a jet is given by the flow speed times a projection effect, sine theta, which tends to hurt you if you want superluminal motion, divided by this 1 minus beta cosine theta, which of course can go to zero. And this can go to zero faster than this goes to zero, and that's why you get superluminal motion. For the receding jet, you flip the sign here, and the denominator goes to 2, and basically you slow things down by about a factor of 2 in apparent motion. Well, let me show you one pretty example of a superluminal source, just show you one map of it. That's 3C120. This is a Seyfert galaxy, or a Seyfert-like galaxy, that's fairly close to us, has a redshift of only 0.03. It's a well-known superluminal source. If you follow very bright features like this one in time, you'll see they move at a few times the speed of light, somewhere between 2 and 10 typically for superluminal sources. And in this case, the apparent superluminal motion is not based on a cosmological redshift. It's not based on assuming that redshifts of 1 or 2 give you very, very distant objects. This is a galaxy that's almost in our local area. And that's why it's a very important galaxy for the superluminal argument. It does not depend on cosmological redshifts. This just gives you basically the typical superluminal characteristics. They've been known for a long time. I wanted just to summarize them here. They always occur in bright, one-sided jets with many blended features. The speeds typically range from about 2 to 10 times the speed of light, that is the apparent speeds. And they can be variable in the same source, And indeed, recently people have found that it's variable in one blob. So this blob of emission that's moving out can actually change its speed a little bit over the course of monitoring that blob. So it's a very complex situation. In some sources, there are rare stationary features. There's a famous source, 4C3925, where you have sort of two stationary blobs and superluminal features going between them. And this is undoubtedly due to environmental things around the jets, where there's a certain region of the jet that lights up and stays fixed, even though the material is moving through it at a very high speed. As you can see from this very pretty image of 3C120, the jets can be curved, they can have bends and kinks, and they can have a very complex underlying structure, which is often helical and filamentary if you make very, very high dynamic range maps. And the last feature of most of superluminal sources is that any extended kiloparsec scale emissions, halos or lobes, tend to be very weak in these sources. Let me go back now to M87, though, because it tends to be an exception to most of these things, and therefore is interesting. And as a contour map, this is the same image I showed you earlier for M87, with the parsec scale jet going off in the same direction as the kiloparsec scale jet. The scale here is about 20 parsecs across this whole image. These are in milliarc second units. And the brightest features in this source, for example, labeled here as N2 and N1, change very slowly in position with time. And here are three images made back in the 80s, and there are more recent ones that John Barreto's made in the 1990s, that show basically that these components move slowly, if at all. The measurements at this time were about a third of the speed, or about a quarter of the speed of light for the apparent motion, that is subluminal motion as opposed to superluminal motion. And the recent measurements even suggested it might be almost stationary. Well, it's very hard to reconcile a very, very one-sided jet with a jet that doesn't have high proper motions. And let me just try to quantify this problem a bit. If you take a plane, which describes the two major parameters that describe the jet, that is the flow speed in the jet going from zero out to the speed of light on this axis, and then the orientation of the jet, where the jet here is aligned precisely at you, to the sine of the angle to the line of sight, and at the top, the jet is perpendicular in the plane of the sky. There's sort of three constraints one can draw from the M87 observations. The first one is this region here, which says that the forward jet is very bright and the counter jet, which isn't seen, is very dim. And the ratio for the jet to counter jet brightness is about 200 to 1 or so, as given by this equation. And that can basically only happen when the jet is moving at a high fraction of the speed of light pretty much towards you. And that's this shaded region here. The proper motion, or the very small motion of the components in the jet, if interpreted as blobs moving with the flow speed, and that's a crucial thing which I'll get to, gives you this constraint here, that is the apparent proper motion is given by this equation, and this was the measurement in that paper, and giving some reasonable range for errors, it says it has to be in this the jet has to be in this parameter space given by those hatched lines. The third constraint on this plot is that basically if you look at the large scale structure of the jet, which is precisely aligned with the small scale structure, there are very bright knots. The brightest is called knot A, which is about 10 arc seconds down the jet, or a few kiloparsecs down the jet in M87. And it has a very sharp feature directly across the line of sight that makes it look like it's precisely a disk that's precisely perpendicular to the line of sight. You're seeing right on the edge of it, something like a Mach disk in a jet. And that can happen, that essentially says that it looks like you're seeing photons coming out sideways from the jet. Now that can happen in many ways, but if you take into account relativistic aberration, which is given by this messy formula up here, where the epsilon is the angle of the stuff being emitted in the co-moving frame with the jet, as opposed to the angle you see, theta, out here. you get this range of possible orientations of the jet. Now you can see, if you look at this, that these three constraints are all mutually exclusive, taken as a group. The only point, the trivial point where they might work down here, the jet is moving exactly at you and exactly at the speed of light. But that's virtually impossible. So something is wrong. And basically you have to throw out one of these three constraints. And then I'll just briefly run through those to show you the sort of quandary that people are in. So the first constraint that we can toss out, let's say, is this one, that the jet appears, has edge-on features inside of a kiloparsec jet. So we only concentrate on these two constraints. We assume this has nothing to do with it for some reason. And then one finds that this is the most logical parameter space for the jet, that as the jet is moving at sort of 80% or so of the speed of light and has a sine of the angle to the line of sight of about 0.05. That says the jet is within about 3 degrees of being aimed right at you, which is a very small percentage of solid angle. It's about a tenth or 0.2% of the available solid angle. I would argue that this is highly unlikely based on the fact that M87 is the nearest active galactic nucleus in the northern hemisphere, and the odds, the a priori odds, although with one object you never want to do that, are very, very low that that would happen. But it is a possibility. By the way, the way you get around the soup, you would have thought that a jet that's aimed at you and has a very high flow speed in the jet would be a superluminal source. There's a little quandary here. It drops out that as you get the angle small enough to the line of sight, you go from superluminal to subluminal motion if you plot out that equation. That is for betas that are not exactly one. You have to go a little less than one for that to happen. Okay, we can now say, okay, well, that didn't work very well. Let's throw out this beaming argument. The jet may be intrinsically one-sided. The counter jet may be hidden almost within the beam of the observations of the nucleus itself, which is very bright. And also it's possible that there's some material around us absorbing the counter jet. So you can throw out this constraint. This would say that the parameters for this jet lie up here in the intersection of these two constraints, and that says that there's a flow speed of about a third of the speed of light down the jet, and that the jet is inclined to line of sight by about 50 degrees. That's very close to the deprojected orientation of the accretion disk in the HST image that I showed you earlier. So that makes some sense. Okay. The third possibility is that you throw out this proper motion constraint. That is, you say you really believe you're seeing some edge-on features in the kiloparsec scale jet, and also by inference in the parsec scale jet, and that beaming explains one-sided jets, and that there's something wrong with the proper motion you see of components, the low proper motion. And this is basically boiled down to a discussion that the pattern speed, the speed at which patterns in VLBI images can be different from the actual flow speed in the jet. And there's certainly a lot of evidence that that might be true. So you could end up with that scenario then. However, all these scenarios have some sort of problems, and I don't think we have sorted this one out yet at all, especially even though this is such a well-studied and close object. There are other interesting features in the M87 jet. Just want to briefly touch on them. If you look down the ridgeline of the jet, which is fairly straight, and then you say, how does the brightness fall away from that ridgeline, the peak brightness? And you'll find it tends to oscillate. I could probably show that on the other view graph here. So if you look on the top here, you can see that if you follow the peak brightness down here, it goes down, up a bit, down a bit, and then if you carry on down here, you can see some big excursions like that. So the jet appears to wiggle. And there's a plot of the deviation from a straight line of the brightness of the jet, And it wiggles with the opening angle of about, it wiggles with a period of about 8 milliarc seconds, although it's not exactly periodic. In addition, the jet, if you look at the full width half maximum of the jet as you go down it, it appears to get broader. It appears to have an opening angle. If you plot the full width at quarter maximum divided by the distance down the jet, you get an opening angle of about 10 degrees. If you use full width half maximum, a more standard measure, it would be about 7 degrees. So the jet appears both to oscillate in brightness as you go down the jet and open as you go down, and also the opening angle tends to wiggle, and that would be interpreted basically as a pinch, that is, the jet is oscillating inward and outward as you go down the jet. The two together suggest that you're seeing not just a simple precession of ballistic blobs, but that you're seeing some MHD instabilities that are probably occurring down the jet. And the fact that they're almost correlated, that is, what would be, for example, a helical instability showing up here and a pinch instability showing up here, does suggest that these things, that MHD processes and instabilities are very important in jet physics. And just to show you one of many MHD jet models that show features like this, this is a work done by Hardy and Clark showing sort of quasi-helical patterns of emission going down a jet that could be similar to M87 in the top there. So not only do we have to worry about precession of components in jets, one has to worry now about instabilities in the jet that can give rise to MHD effects. Well, just to finish up on M87, let me show you the most recent highest resolution image made at long wavelengths. This is the very, very central region of this jet down in here, imaged with a space radio telescope called HALCA, launched by the Japanese, and a ground station, including the VLB array and several other telescopes, to make an image of the brightest components in this radio jet. And you can see even in this image of the very highest brightness stuff that the jet still wiggles very clearly as it goes down the jet. Now we're into the sub-parsec range. And again, you see there's no counterjet. Even at higher resolution, there's not much sign that we're hiding anything over in this region. Well, just to show you some other interesting results of space VLBI research, which is actually just starting. Here's a map of a quasar, 1928 plus 738. And it shows you a tremendous amount of complexity. It's a little bit burned out in this image here. But you can see that very close to the core, which is at the top of this image, there are strong deviations from a straight line. The jet wiggles and bends quite a bit. And must have a fairly wide opening angle. Now remember that things change a lot when you are looking down a jet. I want to show you another one of these toy models that shows you how big an effect this can be. So basically, you take a model in which the jet is aimed nearly at the line of sight, about 10 degrees from us, has this very small opening angle of only 2 degrees. You can sort of see it in that plot. But now you swing it into the line of sight and let it precess, and you get these huge variations. And that's probably what's happening in that space VLBI image that I just showed you a minute ago. Here's another one, 1156 plus 295. It's very interesting because it has a very, very compact core. The jet goes off in this direction and abruptly bends by almost 90 degrees and then goes off in a nearly straight direction. Now that's very hard to do with a simple precessing model. I tried to play around with the parameters with this toy model and came up with something at least interesting that looks like this, even though it doesn't bend by 90 degrees and go straight. This is just to give you a flavor of what can happen when you have very exaggerated parameters for jets. Here's a jet with a very big opening angle, 60 degrees, and I've aimed the jet 60 degrees away from the line of sight so that the opening angle actually comes right through the line of sight occasionally and then goes away from it. And you can see that the forward jet develops a dramatic large bend here, goes out off the map here, and then comes back on here, and the redshifted side completes almost a circle as you're looking down backwards. Kind of interesting. I want to go on to the newer results about circumnuclear disks. The most interesting, well, one of the best studied radio sources in the sky is called 3C84. It's extremely bright. It was thought to be an extremely Doppler-boosted source with a jet nearly aimed at us. And it had been measured. This is the core here. This is the forward jet. And components in that jet had been measured to move subluminally, that is, at about a third the speed of light. And that was consistent with the source being aimed exactly at you. Well, recently, in fact, one of the first observations done with the VLB array that had enough dynamic range showed that there was a counterjet in this source. That's a very rare occurrence. And that there's a gap between the core and the counterjet, which you can see here. Now, this is a map made at very high frequencies, and what is happening is you are seeing through an accretion disk, basically, at this jet. The accretion disk would normally hide the counterjet, but at high enough radio frequencies, you see through the thermal plasma and can see a bit of the receding jet. And you can, just to schematically show you what's going on, I took this simple model and created this. Here's the southern-going jet, which opens up and may be wiggling like this. The red is the receding jet, and the green I've thrown in an accretion disk that's perpendicular to the jet axis. And you can see how it could very easily hide a portion of the counterjet. Another very famous example of an accretion disk and a jet is NGC 4258, which we've heard a lot about today. And I'm running out of time, so I won't spend much time on it. But what I wanted to point out was that the accretion disk here also absorbs the counterjet, the receding jet in NGC 4258, shown here. And in fact, in this source, you can actually measure the opacity through the accretion disk. It's nearly one at 22 gigahertz frequency. Here's a schematic of the model of that. And that tells you that in this accretion disk, you have densities that are about like 10 to the 6th electrons per cubic centimeters and a path length of sort of 1/100th of a parsec or some other variations on the product of those two numbers to give you that opacity. Okay, well, what are some of the other current issues that I don't have time to go over but that have been going on in the field of jets? First of all, there have been a lot of observations of polarization of the synchrotron emission in radio jets. This has been done quite a bit by the group at Brandeis, Dave Roberts and Wardle. And they found some very interesting features that in BLAC objects, the magnetic fields tend to be perpendicular to the jets, indicating that there probably are strong shocks inside the jets. In quasars, the magnetic fields tend to be along the jet, which suggests weaker shocks. There's also some indications of sheaths around the jets, that is, jets are no longer necessarily one nice, uniform, cylindrical thing. They may have a magnetic field wound around it, and you may be getting synchrotron emission both from the sheath and the core, and that can explain a lot of interesting effects. Intraday variables. Recently, there have been many sources discovered that vary at about the 20% level over a day, in total power. And the argument is raised over whether it's intrinsic or extrinsic effects that cause this variability. If the effect were intrinsic, you can calculate that a light travel time across a day leads you to sort of a microarc second angular scale at cosmological distances. And that leads you to brightness temperatures for Jansky sources of about 10 to the 18th degrees. If the effects are extrinsic, and they probably are, caused by scintillation, then you need sources that are smaller than about 30 microarc seconds in order to scintillate. That still gives you a very high brightness temperature of about 10 to the 15th Kelvin, but that's at least a reasonable temperature because it's within reach of Doppler boosting the inverse Compton limit of 10 to the 12th K to 10 to the 15th K value. This is something that needs to be verified by direct measurements with space VLBI, and it should be one of the most important aspects of space VLBI. The frequency dependence of the scintillation of the variability does indicate scintillations. Basically, they go away at high frequencies, which is what you'd expect, because scintillation effects decrease with increasing observing frequency. They also go away at low observing frequency, which at first look might be kind of confusing, but the reason they go away is that the source size gets too big at low frequencies, the intrinsic source size. And if it's not less than about 30 microarc seconds, it won't scintillate. So it's a very strong case, I think, that intraday variables have extrinsic source of variability. I have not had a chance to discuss gamma ray, the gamma ray connection. All gamma ray sources, all TeV and other high-energy gamma ray sources have milliarc second components, are very strong VLBI sources. But the reverse is not true. Not all very complex and strong and compact sources are bright gamma ray emitters. We do not know at this point whether they radiate from nearly the same regions or not. And it's quite an observational challenge to relate the variations in the radio to the variations in the gamma rays, because both sort of flare repeatedly, and you would need essentially frequent and total complete monitoring of many sources over long periods at both gamma rays and radio to try to tie this down. It's a very important problem, but of course a very hard one to attack. There are two other questions here which are also important ones, which I have not had a chance to even approach, although I did mention NHD instabilities. Let's see, do I have about 2 minutes left? Can I tell the story of Sag A star? Okay. Well, the nearest AGN should be Sag A star. Here's a radio image made with the VLA of the galactic center region, sort of parsec scale across here. Here's a bright point source, Sagittarius A star, unresolved with the VLA at about a few tenths of an arc second. When you look at this source with VLBI techniques, you see an ellipse, an east-west ellipse, an axial ratio of almost 2-1, which changes as the wavelength squared. It just scales. At longer wavelengths, it's bigger. And so that's a clear indication that all you're seeing is a scatter-broadened image. The fact that it's elliptical is kind of surprising. It means the scattering is anisotropic, but that appears to be the case, and it's seen in other sources too. But try as we might, and although VLBI observations get near and actually below an astronomical unit in size, not a parsec now, an astronomical unit, there's no indication that there is any intrinsic jet in this source. If you look in the infrared, you register the infrared and the radio very carefully. You can get a position of Sagittarius A star on this infrared image. And that's an interesting trick. You can read in the Menten et al. Paper in 1997 about this. You see there's nothing in the infrared there at all at 2 microns. And in fact, it's also a very weak X-ray source. There is X-ray emission from the general region. We don't know how much of it comes from Sag A star, but it certainly is not a lot. So what is going on with Sagittarius A star? We know there's, from the motions of the stars, as we heard about yesterday, there's about 3 million solar masses contained within about a hundredth of a parsec of this position of Sag A star. So what is Sag A star? Is it a supermassive black hole or not? Certainly from the luminosity, this is a very weak source. I mean, it's strong because it's close to us. It's about a Jansky. But many contact binaries can be a Jansky at radio wavelengths very, very easily. And indeed, the total emission from Sag A star across the electromagnetic spectrum is probably less than a few Eddington luminosity for a few solar mass objects. So, for example, it could be some very unusual contact binary based on its luminosity alone. But we know more about it. There have been recent measurements that I've been working on using the VLB array in its highest frequency mode at 43 gigahertz to actually determine the proper motion of Sag A star. So what you do is you look, and here's a picture of the sky. You look at Sag A star, and then you switch off and calibrate on a background quasar and back and forth, and you get an image of Sag A star. And in 1995, in March, it was up there on the top near the origin of that plot. A year later, on two different days, it appeared here and here. And a year later, it appeared here. It's moving at 6 milliarc seconds per year. It's moving almost totally in the galactic plane, which is this solid line. The best fit to the motion, the weighted least squares fit to those points, is the dashed line here. And they're basically indistinguishable. Now, you're not seeing an intrinsic motion of Sag A star. What you're seeing here is that the Sun is orbiting the Milky Way. It takes about 220 million years for the Sun to go around the Milky Way. Since Sagittarius star is in the foreground, effectively, compared to quasars, it appears to move. And this is all caused by the motion of the Sun around the galactic center. And it's really astounding that with the VLB array, you can basically detect it almost in 10 days, the orbit of the Sun around the galactic center. Well, that's not of great interest to this, the discussion of black holes. What is the fact that there's very little left over for a peculiar motion of Sagittarius star. And the limit is about 20 kilometers per second. It has to be moving at less than 20 kilometers per second with respect to external radio sources. It's sitting at the dynamical center of the Milky Way to very high accuracy. This has been measured both with this measurement here with the VLB array and by Don Backer and Dick Schrammick over a longer time using the VLA, and we get about the same results. Now, basically, if you have an object that's moving very slowly in the center of a lot of objects, stars that are moving very fast, as you heard yesterday, they're moving at about 1,000 kilometers per second close into Sagittarius star. Sagittarius star could not be a solar mass object. It would be kicked around sooner or later, even if there's a lot of other mass there. And it would be booted out and achieve the same velocity as stars of a similar mass. So it can't be an X-ray binary, a contact binary of any sort. And in fact, the limits you can put on this very conservatively are that the mass of Sagittarius star, that is the mass tied to the radio emission, exceeds about 1,000 solar masses, and probably is much higher, and is totally consistent with Sagittarius star being a 2.6 million solar mass black hole, as inferred from the stellar motions. So I think I'll stop there. There's a summary if you want to read it well.
Can you explain the Sagittarius lack of jets and all by saying it's a spherical accretion onto it and that there's just not an accretion disk there to make a jet?
Sure. Might be. Possible. I can admit, the interesting thing was 5 years ago, if you had asked any radio astronomer, what are you going to see when you get enough resolution, go to high enough frequency to see through the scattering cloud? And everyone would have said, you're going to see a jet down there. It doesn't seem to be the case.
So when you look at, say, the distribution of jets, for example, it suddenly appears that there's more cases than one jet than just a physical alignment for the larger. So would you say that the explanation of this would be a very nearly one beta, or just because we cannot see the counter-shape?
Yeah. Well, I don't think I although I'm trying to be a little iconoclastic here and point out a lot of discrepancies, I think the basic picture of Doppler boosting giving one side of jets is probably right. There are just problems with details about this, but I'm sure that's a big part of the answer.
And the question was, why don't you see more?
Oh, well, that's it's a selection effect, probably. The Doppler-boosted ones are easy to see, and the ones that aren't probably aren't. Probably that's the big piece of it.
The recent new work with HST will be showing proper up to 6C and
yes, I want... Yeah. Okay. I don't think it solves the problem at all. First of all, I don't think I necessarily believe that. I'm going to remain skeptical about this. I've always been skeptical about the superluminal speeds quoted for kiloparsec scale structures. Basically, there have been two sources where that's been quoted. One is in 3C120, which is the superluminal source I showed you this very pretty picture of. At kiloparsec scales, Craig Walker did a very detailed analysis of these fairly big structures you're looking at now. When you go out to the kiloparsec scale, they're now arc seconds, and thought he had convincing evidence that some of the material of the kiloparsec scale is moving faster than the speed of light. He made observations then over a much longer time frame and found the effect went away. John Beretta has worked very hard both on the radio and the HST at the kiloparsec scale, For the cases where you have the best chance of measuring it cleanly, for example, knot A in the M87 jet, which is the brightest knot that's 10 arc seconds down the jet, it's got a very sharp edge, you measure half C. And that's probably a pretty good measurement. The measurements of the superluminal motions, I bet either with HST or with the VLA, basically require looking at extended structures with fairly big beams and inferring motions from things that change in awkward ways and that are very susceptible to, I think, problems coming from image infidelity. That is, you might have an image that looks very pretty, but things might be wrong at the 1% level in the actual flux of a piece of a component. And that can cause you a lot of trouble in terms. So I would be very skeptical of superluminal motion at the kiloparsec scale at the moment.
Yes. Are you also skeptical about the 7 millimeter DLTA that maps by low of Sagittarius A star?
Why? Yeah, I'm going to be a real skeptic here, right? What Felix is referring to is the Sagittarius A star, which I said was just an east-west ellipse that scattered broadened at almost all observations so far. There have been claims at high frequency VLBA observations and also some high millimeter wavelength observations to see through the scattering and see an intrinsic size. I think it's 50-50 right now. Certainly, I've made images at 43 gigahertz, and Fred Lowe and others have, and you always get something that departs from the scattering law. But the important thing is it depends crucially on calibrations at one or two of the VLBA antennas. Since this source is very far in the south, and a couple of antennas are really giving you all the information. And the amplitude calibration is based on gain curves, as they're called, which were made maybe a year before the observations. And so someone has to actually recalibrate those antennas of the VLB array during the observations very carefully before I'm convinced of that. So I think it's 50-50 right now.
I'd like to make a comment about the difficulties posed by observations of intraday variability. Mm-hmm. If you believe that the Doppler factor is necessary in order to compress the time variation, then you get a factor of dq. And so to get to the apparent 10 to the 18 from 10 to the 12, you need a gamma factor of 100, which creates tremendous problems for the efficiency of radiation.
Right.
I think you had a factor of d cubed to help you out with scintillation, but in fact, I think it's actually only one power of d in that case.
Is that right?
There you're using the Doppler boost just to increase the brightness temperature, but it doesn't help you with the time variability, because that's all given by scintillation. And then, so you still have a problem when you need a gamma factor of maybe 100 in order to go from 10 to the 12 to 10 to the 14 or 15. At least that's what I remember.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah. So it's still a problem, and there might be you might need to invoke coherent radiation mechanisms or something more exotic than what people have tried so far.
It's scary.
Yeah.
Okay, that's about 20. Sorry, what am I saying? About 2 milliarc seconds in that map. That's a fairly long wavelength map. If you want higher resolution, one should, of course, use 6 centimeters at Helica, which people have been doing. You get down to, I think, if I remember correctly, about 100 Schwarzschild radii at the higher frequency maps. Now, in the future, with space VLBI running at much higher frequencies, that is with a new telescope, which is being planned both in Japan and hopefully here, one should be able to get down to 10 Schwarzschild radii or so with VLBI observations. And that should become very interesting.
That's a theoretical comment and observational point. One of the things we're discussing here is efficiency of accretion. As you pointed out, the energetics in something like Thick Bay, most of the luminosity is in particle luminosity, not photon luminosity. So the total amount of mass of the retrieval has to be corrected. It's a very large correction factor in the luminosity. It's enormous factor in capability. Mm-hmm. So apparently, for some reason, we have discussed yesterday, radio law convert most of their mass energy into particles and not so much photons. So, second comment is the calm density that you inferred in 4058 is beautiful to use with the X-ray calm density for that sort of 10 to
22. Yeah, the whole thing's a very neat picture.
So there are many ways of seeing into those central regions, and
the
science
of
these
customers coming to
green.
Is there one more over here? Okay, it's going to be a lively session.
I can't hear over here. Just a second. Yeah. The question was about the correlation between the optical and the radio intraday variability. That's a tricky one. It's not been actually demonstrated for intraday variables. It's been demonstrated by inference for longer longer period variations. That would be a problem if it's actually demonstrated that they are correlated at the hour point.
Okay. Thank you very much.